probably you all know him already. So he's a distinguished professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's famous for his work in particle physics and quantum field theory, and especially for his development of effective field theory for general relativity. And in the 90s, he made some very important seminal contributions exactly. So this is his first of four lectures that he will give at these symmetry schools. And so the others will be tomorrow at 11, and then Thursday and Friday at 9 a.m. So there is a time change to keep in mind. So thank you, John, for accepting our invitation. And start. Thanks.
So I'm here to tell you some things about effective field theory. And it's a subset of quantum field theory. Quantum field theory is a rich and diverse topic and is covered in many of the textbooks. But we've gone through a bit of a paradigm shift in the practical aspects of quantum field theory. And that often comes under this name, effective field theory. We think of things differently now than are presented in many of the textbooks. And so I take it as my mandate to show you some things that are interesting, live somewhat outside of the textbooks, hopefully are useful, et cetera. So here are the coordinates for me, and I'm gonna have these lecture notes posted. I'm writing them on the tablet in order to post them later, so they, lecture notes should be posted on my webpage, and you can probably find them there if you want. So we're theorists here. I'd like to start with an observation which is actually relevant for the philosophy of effective field theories, and it's basically that physics is an experimental science. Now, that's a truism, but it's worth keeping in mind here. We have this picture. We hear these stories of the great man sitting in a room like Einstein, looking out at the clock tower in Bern, and pulling out of their head these remarkable theories. But in fact, that gets the ordering backwards. In fact, The reason that Einstein was even bothered by some of the issues that he was thinking about was because of the work of Cavendish and Ampere and Faraday, et cetera, beforehand. So we sometimes get the arrow of causality in science backwards. Even something like string theory, which you think is of as the most extreme of these grand theories, came out of hadron spectroscopy in particle physics, measuring the masses of resonance states. So the scientific method is really experiment leading to hypothesis. And in this spirit, effective field theory is a humble quantum field theory. Rather than trying to do a grand synthesis, you don't need a full theory. You don't even need a complete theory. So not needing the complete theory, You work with what nature gives you at the scales you're interested in. And this idea that you don't need a complete theory shows up in a lot of what we do in, sorry. In thinking about the scales of a theory, what happens beyond the scales that we're living at doesn't matter to a large extent. There are going to be two meanings of effective here. One of them, when we talk about an effective theory, we often talk about a low energy approximation to a more complete theory. So that's one meaning of effective that we commonly use. But the other meaning is much more the common usage that we see in the world. It's useful. This is the useful things to do. There's a theory may contain a lot of baggage that's completely irrelevant for what we're doing. The other point I need to make at the start is that EFT is a tool. And you use tools in many different applications. So this, if I were a woodworker telling you about how to use a chisel, it would matter whether I'm using it in building a house or building a musical instrument. And the case here is also, if you go out there and you look at effective field theory presentations or reviews, they're all very different. They come at it from different angles. And we haven't yet standardized our descriptions, presentations of effective field theory like we do for E&M. If somebody presents E&M, it's basically it's the same pattern all the time. Everyone presents this differently. And so I'm going to do my version of it. That's what you get. My mandate was effective field theory. This was a school on symmetry, so I put a symmetries in the title, and of course that comes into much of effective field theory. Anyhow, I'm going to do other good things also. So I'm going to talk about how to use path integrals in some new ways. I'm going to do background field method. If we get there, I'll try heat kernel methods, operator product expansions, some good things. So hopefully, if it's not exactly what you're looking forward to, hopefully it's useful stuff for you. I'll start today doing simple stuff, which is in QED, because I've been asking about, I don't know your backgrounds, what you know really at all. In asking around about that, I've been told that you will know QED up through the renormalization of QED. So we'll start there. You can tell me as you're leaving whether I overshoot or undershot you on this. Today we'll also do an introduction to path integrals where I'm going to do it in this storytelling mode rather than a derivation. But I want to use path integral language at some stage, so I'm going to at least do that. So if I'm underestimating your background, you can let me know. But then, of course, you may not know everyone else's background. So some quick bookkeeping. One I said already, which is notes on the webpage. So this thing will be able to save these notes. Hopefully works fine. I have to handwrite this here. So I know that my handwriting is not the best in the world. It's in grammar school, I failed handwriting, which is hard to do, but I did. If you have any troubles with reading what I write, ask me at the time, because it won't be easier to read after you've passed up the opportunity. I am going to do h bar c equals to 1 units, and I'll use relativistic notation. My metric is plus, minus, minus, minus. No booing up there. P mu is E squared minus M squared, E squared minus P squared, sorry. Equals M squared, it's positive. And propagators, there's actually turns out there's a convention in propagators also. Propagator for a scalar particle, my convention is p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And I didn't actually realize this until recently, that many textbooks differ on putting factors of I in here. So you have to be a little bit careful, in particular that first I in front of the df is sometimes dropped. But anyhow, that's not to me too much there. Let's see, down here is some things. I have a book that I, since I wrote it with my colleagues, I use a lot of material from that, the dynamics of the Stannard model. The good news is it's now totally free. We agreed to put it as open access, and so you can go out and download it. You can Google it in my name with SCOAP3, or I have the link now on the webpage, so if you go back to the webpage, you'll see the link. So I recommend you do it. I have an earlier introductory book, which I think is not quite what you're after in this setting, but which actually I draw some material from also. And there is also a bunch of other books, including one by Cliff Bridges, who's sitting up in the back there, which are very nice books that present other viewpoints of this tool. Okay, so that's basically my introduction. So if there's any questions, let's take them now or I'll get to work. Anybody? All right. So I'm trying to start out with things that you know, at least know at some level. So I'm going to start out with QED. The Lagrangian for QED is minus a quarter F mu nu plus psi bar I d slash minus m. And of course, we can do some things with that. So our degrees of freedom are photons and fermions, or scalars. The Feynman rules are, if we are simple, we just have this vertex. It's either minus I e gamma mu, or minus I, if this is p prime, and q flowing in that way, 2p plus q. If I have a scalar, the simplest vertex, simplest interaction, is then, if I want to write that out, it's minus im is minus I e squared for each of the vertices. Oh, I guess I should have written out the propagator here. Well, we'll see it right now. So I have fermions on the side here. The propagator is minus I over q squared minus I epsilon g mu nu, and then u bar gamma nu u over here, and one of those indices should have been up, obviously. So the propagator, if it's a vector, has this extra minus sign there. This goes over in the non-relativistic limit to the matrix element being just e squared over the spatial vector squared q vector squared minus I epsilon. Because the in the non-relativistic limit, so this is the we get the time-like pieces of the four momentum are dominated by the mass term. They essentially give mass minus mass, And so it's essentially zero, and the spatial part is the piece that survives. We can have a couple uses of this. We can get a potential out by Fourier transforming it. And that just gives us the Coulomb potential, E squared over 4 pi r. Or we could do scattering amplitudes, d sigma d omega, which follows from the same thing as 4 m squared alpha squared over q to the fourth. Okay, so that's great. So how do we use these things? Well, you might say we just go out and we use them. But the point that's needed and is part of the narrative here is that first we have to measure. At this stage, theories don't tell you what these coupling constants are. You have to measure them at some level. And what we've written up here are two ways to measure it. The theory, you could take the long-range static potential or the scattering amplitudes. Either way, these in the non-relativistic limit at small momentum, large distance, give you a measurement, and we find that alpha is 1 over 137. Okay. Fine. Now we keep going. Okay, if we keep going, we would start doing things like this, or those are iterations of the lowest order interaction. Depending on what you want to do, you treat them differently. If you're doing bound states versus scattering amplitudes, they're actually, the treatment is somewhat different for those guys. There's the one that which we will talk about is the vacuum polarization. There are vertex corrections. Etc. So there are all these radiative corrections. The one I want to talk about there is the vacuum polarization. So if we just plug that in, so we've got this thing to calculate. I'm not going to calculate it. I won't calculate it at all. I won't even show it to you yet because that's not part of the narrative at this stage. But I have to name it. So it's pi mu nu of q squared, and it has a particular structure, q mu q nu minus g mu nu q squared is the tensor structure times a scalar function pi with no indices on it. It's a function of q squared. The tensor structure is required by gauge invariance. If you dot the momentum into this, it has to vanish, and that makes that. So now we calculate this guy. And yeah, let me do it. All right, let me look at what's in the center. So back up here. I'm mainly interested in this part here, so let's just do that part there. That part now is, I have, for this diagram, I have minus I g mu nu over q squared. I get this tensor structure q mu, q, that's g mu nu. Actually, it's q nu. Q alpha, okay, so one of the indices is contracted to one of the vertices, the other to the other, minus g mu alpha q squared pi minus I g alpha beta over q squared times pi of q squared. Anyway, so some stuff. And the main point that is needed here is basically when these momentum, the q mu, q nu, act on the external states, they also disappear because of the current constant by gauge invariance, q dotted into the vertices gives zero. The piece that survives is this q squared, 1 over q squared, 1 over q squared. And so this ends up looking like the original matrix element, which I calculated before, times minus pi of q squared. Okay, so just the multiplicative factor, this pi. Dimensions work out just right for that to be sitting like that. Okay, so now we have d sigma d omega is 4m squared over q to the fourth alpha 1 minus pi of q squared squared. Okay. So we're now, it's great. Now we just have to calculate that, go off and verify the loop predictions of QED. But actually we can't do that. And the important point is that we're not done. We can't just proceed. We have to, the point is that we have to remeasure. This has changed what we previously measured in a way that's crucial to the understanding of the theory. What we measured before was we measured a parameter we can call alpha, 1 minus pi q squared close to zero. Let's call it equals to zero. And so since I'm going to have to change names a little bit, let me put a zero there and a zero here. And it's this guy that's 1 over 137, not what we had before. So since theory doesn't predict these numbers, we have to do this remeasurement. To this order, then, we can make an approximation. Well, actually, this isn't, as written, it's not an approximation, but it is. Alpha 0, 1 minus pi of q squared is to this order alpha, the real alpha, 1 minus pi of q squared minus pi of 0, brackets. So really what we are after is not pi itself, but delta pi. Okay, and now we have a real prediction. We have d sigma d omega is proportional to this alpha 1 minus delta pi of q squared. Okay, and now we can apply it. Okay, everything is now in terms of measurable quantities. All right, as I said, I'm not gonna calculate it yet. I'll show you the calculation soon, but at the moment, just to keep the storyline going, delta pi of q squared, well, I've subtracted off pi of zero, so you can imagine what it looks like. If we're taking pi and Taylor expanding it, the next term would be of order q squared. So it's q squared. It's got a factor of alpha in it. It's dimensionless because it was 1 minus delta pi. So it has to be dimensionless, so it has to be divided by m squared. And the only thing you have to do the calculation, it's 1 over 15 pi. Okay, but everything else is sort of obvious. If I then have a matrix element, minus I over q squared, 1 minus delta pi, it goes over what I Fourier transform. The 1 over q squared piece goes to the 1 over r, so it's alpha over 4 pi r. And this next piece goes over to alpha over 15. Actually, it's 60 pi squared, sorry. Actually, I will write this as number since I don't have it in my notes, to be honestly clear. Delta 3 of x. Okay, it's local as an interaction because it's basically q squared sitting up there divided by q squared, so it's a constant. So then you Fourier transform that, you get a delta function. That's not particularly the important point here, but when we do gravity at the end of the lectures, that's going to be a distinction from a certain set of quantum effects. But so this is all stuff that you know. By definition, I've been told you know that, so you know it. But I've rephrased it a bit just because I want, at this stage, to focus on the idea of measurement. And in fact, I called it remeasuring rather than renormalization. But what you obviously see is this is the renormalization program for QED. But now what I'd like to do is I'd like to take this operator and write it as an effective Lagrangian. And we can do that because that structure, it's some local operator. We saw that its effect is a delta function, but it's in fact local even before using that. The effect of this could be written out as it's minus e squared over 240 pi squared m squared f mu nu box f mu nu. So what does that give me? Well, of course, the e squareds and the m squareds are obvious. Box turns into a factor of q squared. And so now there's a new Feynman rule where if I have this new effect of Lagrangian like put in like that, it's I alpha over 15 pi m squared q squared g mu nu minus, no, I'm sorry. Well, okay, I can do g mu nu q squared minus q mu q nu, though to keep things right, I have to put a minus sign there now. Okay, so the tensor structure of f mu nu times f mu nu gives me these factors of g mu nu and q squareds. The box gives me that factor of q. And then to use it, I do this, and I do this, and I get the matrix element that I calculated before. So knowing this, then I can apply it here. And while this one is particularly trivial, because QED isn't the richest of theories, I could take this into many other contexts. And instead of having to calculate that vacuum polarization every time, I can just use this as an operator in other settings also. So this represents the effect of the massive particle. So this works for q squared less than m squared, because that was where I started this Taylor expansion. We'll come back to the other. So if you, for example, wanted to include the effect of the muon on atomic physics, all you would do is you take this formula here, put the mass being the muon mass, and then look to see what effect that interaction has. Okay, so we're going to write these effective Lagrangians a lot while we're doing here. What I'd like to do at this stage is just take a step, again, to make sure that we're all on the same page. I want to do dimensional analysis so that I can just use it, and you could all look at a formula and mentally do the dimensional analysis piece. So, the action is a pure number, because we, in path integrals, we do e to the is, and so the action is a pure number. It's written as the integral over all space of a Lagrange density. So from delta x, delta p being of order h bar, which is 1, it tells us that the dimensions of x are one over some energy variable. So that derivatives go like an energy variable, so which is obvious, they bring down a factor of momentum. Looking at that, then d4x is 1 over energy to the fourth, so Lagrangians have dimensions of energy to the fourth. So when we're doing power counting, we're looking for Lagrangians that carry powers of energy to the fourth. From f mu nu, from that, f has a derivative on the field A. There's two derivatives there, so that tells me that the field A carries dimensions energy to the one. I'm sorry, I have notation misprint there. Fields are energy to the one. Fermions are energy to the three halves, sorry. And so if I wrote out F box F like I did previously, that's an operator that overall carries dimensions energy to the sixth. So if I have a constant in front of it, that tells me that that constant has to be 1 over m squared. So then it works. So why? So this is a perfectly good Lagrangian. It has the right dimensions now. Why isn't it there in QED to begin with? Okay, it's gauge invariant. We look at that. It's completely physical, but it's not there in the original theory. It's said to be non-renormalizable by this power counting argument, which means that it has coefficients with inverse powers of the masses. That's a terrible phrasing, because in fact, we will see that you can easily, readily renormalize non-renormalizable theories. But nevertheless, that's historically what we've got. And so in general, as we go through this, we'll have some operators and those operators will have some dimensionality, and the Lagrangians then will carry 1 over m to the d minus 4 times the operators. So the terminology is, if the dimension is 4 or less, we have renormalizable, otherwise it's non-renormalizable. Okay, so now back to the main narrative. Okay, so at this stage I want to, let's make sure, let's hope this works. There we go. So I'm going to try to copy that. Go back, paste it. Let's just go back and return to this function that we have there. You can see that well enough. I don't need to expand it. So this is, I want to use this to get a few more lessons out, pi of q squared. So you start off with, in these Feynman diagram, integrating over the momentum, and you end up with this formula here. Let's try to lasso this guy. Very good. Yeah, well, let's see if I can expand that a bit. This I'm going to use a bit more, so let's try expanding that. All right. Yeah, we may just leave it at that. So you can read that, right? Yeah. Okay. So here's the formula that comes out there, and you see the division into the piece that was here, that was the pi of 0. Oh, sorry. Here, pi of 0 was there, and the delta pi is that q squared over 5. This has been done in dimensional regularization. I'm hoping that people have all seen that. I'm not going to introduce it separately. Basically, you extend here, epsilon is 4 minus d over 2. And so you extend the dimensionality. You get divergences as you get close to 4 dimensions. They come with the 1 over epsilon is the divergent piece. There's a parameter when you extend the dimensions, there's an extra dimensionful parameter mu, which ends up appearing in logs, which is completely unphysical and disappears from everything in the end, which is actually a hint in itself. Mu is that parameter. So I've done integral d4p and put that as 2 pi to the fourth mu to the 4 minus d integral d to the p to the fourth over 2 pi to the d. Okay. And so there's that parameter sitting there too. So, and there's interesting stories associated with that in knowing that it ends up having to disappear from all physical quantities. But we saw it did. It sits in pi of 0, and pi of 0 was just disappeared. But the piece that I actually want to talk about next is the log m squared that sits there. So pi of 0 has a log m squared. Now, this could be any particle's mass. You know, I'm sure that as we started out, you figured I was talking about the electron. I could really have been talking about the top quark. So this could be any particle, any charged particle. Now, it's a bit strange now, again, using this mantra of physics is experimental science. That could be a particle we haven't discovered yet. There could be charged particles beyond the range of our experiments. They have gone into the calculation of the electric charge. Now, you don't worry about the q squared over m squared piece because that's going to be tiny when they're very beyond the range of our experiments. But I get a log m squared, and that, in fact, only gets bigger with energy. So this could be undiscovered particles, too. That says undiscovered in case you can't read the scribbles. So don't ever try calculating the value of alpha, because the value of alpha depends on the mass of particles that you have no idea about. It depends on the mass of the top quark, the up quark. Don't bother trying to calculate it. It has real dependence on these particles. But fortunately, it disappeared in the measurement, okay? So when we measured, it disappeared. Or when we remeasured, renormalized. And that's actually a crucial theorem that's useful for effective field theories. It's the Applequist-Carazone theorem. So let's write this out. And we've seen this demonstrated in what we do there, we've done. So the effects of a heavy particle it's not that they don't influence physics totally. We see that they do. Appears either as a renormalization of a coupling in a renormalizable theory. So I have to write this out. Yeah, let's do some abbreviations of a coupling. Or is suppressed by powers of a heavy mass. Now this rereading the paper, They don't mention something that's relevant for what we found up here. Let's go back up here. I also didn't emphasize it enough. The Lagrangian that we found here is a local Lagrangian. The local is the point that I want to emphasize right now. Now, the I should have, before coming in here this morning, reread the Apicus-Carrizoni theorem, but I know from the abstract that it doesn't say that it's in a local Lagrangian. But that's certainly how we apply it everywhere. What we saw the mass, the logarithmic dependence going into the renormalization of the electric charge, the suppressed by powers of the heavy mass going into that new effect of Lagrangian, and the locality is crucial for what we're doing, is basically the uncertainty principle. If you apply the uncertainty principle, effects that come from very large energy compared to what we're doing have a very large delta P, delta E, whatever, from what we're, where we are. Therefore, their effects are at very short distance. And we'll see in more detail how we can Taylor expand these. I mean, this is obviously what we're going to do, is a bunch of local terms. And the locality is an important point here. There is actually a caveat to the Apicus-Carrizoni theorem, so let's just say it. The caveat has to do with if you take a particle heavy and it removes the symmetries of the theory. Since we're doing symmetries, so this is not true if the symmetry is broken. And the classic example of this is if I take the top mass large and keep the B mass, the bottom quark mass, small. All right. If I take that limit, the top quark effects don't decouple. You can get residual observable non-decoupled effects. You can get MT squared effects. Because this breaks the SU2 symmetry of the theory. The theory has been predicated. On the fact that these doublets carry the same interactions. And that's no longer true now. But if I took both, M top and M bottom large, there are no effects. So it's an interesting organizing principle that you should keep in mind. If I take the whole doublet to be large, it doesn't matter. If I take one part of the doublet large, you get large corrections. So this is basically the first organizing principle of effective field theories. Yeah, just a second. Thereafter. Yes, question. Yes.
So by this theorem, what we mean is that, look, when we talk about separation of scales and physics at very high energies not affecting the physics we are measuring,
right.
And that's why any method of regulation, means any regularization works.
That's right.
And so I had assumed initially that this is a more philosophical statement, but is this theorem saying that locality implies that whenever there is symmetry?
So yes, the uncertainty principle guarantees locality. Apicus-Carrizoni tells you where the effects go. They go into, in all those cases, they're local effects. The electric renormalization of the electric charge being one local effect. It's the effect, however, that's not suppressed by powers of the heavy mass. And the residual effects after that are suppressed by powers of the heavy mass. So there's sort of a two-pronged point here. We have the physics decouples, and the suppressed physics is local, is also part of what we're doing. Okay?
And also from the caveat, it means that this decoupling in symmetry broken scenarios does not work.
Yes, well, that's right, it does not work. I mean, the example I showed you is a violation of decoupling by taking one part of a doublet heavy and the other not. And the reason is basically because that theory has extra divergences in it. So it becomes extra sensitive to high energy stuff. You can't absorb this effect into any renormalized parameter because the theory has too few renormalized parameters. Too few parameters.
So the theory then is not renormalizable?
Yeah, so the theory with the M top goes to infinity and M bottom fixed is not renormalizable because you violated the doublet structure. Good, thank you very much. Anybody else want to ask? Okay, so the first organizing principle is this locality and decoupling. Okay, so now I have to do this little song and dance now. And so I want you to temporarily imagine that you haven't just heard what I just described. You're back sitting in old quantum mechanics class where I'm teaching how to do time-independent perturbation theory for the first time. Because I always do this there. It's always interesting the range of answers that you get. So I do this little segment on why do quantum calculations work. Okay, and the formula I've just derived is some perturbative formula, which is the sum over intermediate states, some final state, intermediate state V, initial state over E minus EI. Okay, which seems innocent enough, but now, the song and dance is to say that this is all intermediate states that are possible. And that includes things, physics is an experimental science. It includes things that we have not discovered yet. Yet. So how can you ever do a quantum calculation if in these intermediate states you have to sum over all states that we haven't found? Okay, and so if you're in the mindset of an introductory course, you might answer, well, the energy denominator suppresses it. But it's actually not true. Because that sum integral, the sum over I really is integral over momentum, d3p, and so it in fact emphasizes high energy. You might say, well, the matrix elements to that, to all those funny intermediate states are small. But it's not true also, because in fact we've just seen that finding a top quark with a top quark contribution to the low energy atomic physics is logarithmically dependent on the top quark mass. So it doesn't decouple. It doesn't decouple in that sense. It doesn't disappear. It's not that they're small. The answer is so we go around about like this with students proposing it. But we've really just seen the answer now. It's the uncertainty principle, Applequist-Carazzone. Decoupling. So you don't even really, really understand low energy quantum mechanics without knowing this basic fact. Okay. So we can do this. I just want to show you one more term before moving on, because it emphasizes something. The next term in this expansion for QED is actually the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian, which is the effect of, with four photons involved. The Lagrangian here is, well, it's 1 over 4 pi, well, e to the fourth, 4 pi squared, 90 m to the fourth, f mu nu squared plus 7/4 mu nu f dual mu nu squared, pull that out, where this f dual is 1/2 the epsilon tensor times F. It's the so-called dual field strength tensor. So it's one point of writing it out is just so you can see it, which you probably have seen it before. But let's again do dimensional analysis on this. That operator there, F squared, F to the fourth, goes like energy to the fourth power. So therefore, I need the 1 over M to the fourth. By dimensional analysis, and all you have to do is calculate the various numbers that appear there. I say that that's all you have to do. That's not quite fair. It's a somewhat painful calculation, but nevertheless, done once, it's done forever. You don't have to do it every time you want to do another piece of physics. The other thing to say here is the role of gauge symmetry. So we have to respect the underlying gauge invariance. These quantum corrections don't violate gauge invariance. So the result has to be written in some gauge invariant form. So it can't be the following. It can't be a mu, a nu, a mu, a nu. It can't be that. That's forbidden by gauge invariance. It must be this, we know ahead of time, be 1 over m to the fourth, f to the fourth, because that's the only form that's gauge invariant. We saw that previously, but when doing power counting, one has to respect the gauge invariance. Okay. So that's first organizing. What if not massive? Okay, if we look at this result that we got up here, that operator that goes like 1 over m squared sitting right there, and you try taking m to 0, for example, that's going to blow up. But it doesn't really. If you go back to the original calculation that where we calculated it, we have this. Oh, where'd it go? Oh, I hadn't calculated it yet. There it is. We're sitting there. And we now I want to focus on another piece that's sitting there. The expansion that I gave was when the mass was large compared to the momentum. And that was appropriate for what we wanted to do. We wanted to remeasure the electric charge in the scattering amplitude at large distances. But here, now we're interested in the small mass limit. And you can see that, in fact, the mass goes to zero limit is smooth. There's no, not even any log m squared in this limit, surprisingly. And you can see it from the integral that sits above there, that integral, the Feynman parameterized integral. You can just take m to zero and you get a fine answer. Okay, so there's something different about what happens at low energies. So what I want to write here is then delta pi goes like log of q squared over mu squared for q squared much, much less than m. There's dot stuff there. So how do I deal with that? Well, there's not much I can do with that. You can't write out a local Lagrangian. For that. And let's just see this a little bit. If we have a Lagrangian with a factor of q squared, so this is the analytic stuff. So if I can Taylor expand it, it's analytic around q squared is equal to zero. And if I have something that goes like integral d4q, q squared e to the I q dot x. This can be written, and basically what we did before, as minus an integral, minus box being the wave equation differential operator on the integral d4, q e to the I q dot x. And let's just to be fair, let's put the 2 pi to the fourth. Which is then minus box on delta of x. Okay? So the reason this became local was because I can factor out that box out of the operators and write things as derivatives of delta functions. So when I see an analytic function, I can do that. But non-analytic functions, if I have the integral d4, excuse me, q, 2 pi to the fourth, log q squared, e to the iq dot x. Let me, just for the sake here, I'm going to write x minus y because I want to. Let's actually look. This is some function of x minus y, but it's certainly not local. So those pieces are not local. I could try writing this. This would be, I could write an effective action for this. I could write some effective action is integral d4x, d4y, f mu nu at x, this L of x minus y, f mu nu at y. And in fact, we won't bother with the coefficient. I have it here, but we could write a piece that reproduces that logarithm in the vacuum polarization function, but it's not local. And so the organizing principle also has the corollary that high energy effects are local and low energy effects are not local. So this is part of the same organizing principle. you can differentiate low energy dynamical effects from high energy ones by their locality properties. Okay, fair enough. Where are we? What are we doing here? Oh, geez. So, second organizing principle. Yes?
When you say low energy effects, you mean particles with lower masses?
Well, in here I meant masses that are of the same order as the energies we're working at. So the scales here, we're working at some energy. That's this Q squared.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're doing some experiment.
Yeah.
And the scaling question that you ask is whether the masses are big compared to that energy or of that energy,
yeah,
or much smaller is also the same order. And so that's the distinction in this case is carried by the energy that we're working at, big or small compared to that.
But when we say low energy, it's not low Q squared, it's somehow low M, right?
You're right. Thank you for doing that. So let's see. Low energy, let's put dynamical. Dynamical. The dynamics of loops, the dynamics of other particles, when viewed at their energies, are not local functions. Okay, good. Thanks for that. That's great. The second organizing principle is also something we've seen. It's the energy expansion. And it's basically something that we've said a few times now. I'm Taylor expanding. The functions that we have. Taylor expanding. All right. I've got Q squared over M squared plus Q to the fourth over M to the fourth plus dot, dot, dot. These appear in effective interactions as higher and higher and if I'm working at low enough energies compared to this mass, I can just disregard the higher order ones. I can disregard whatever is small. So we organize the calculations in a Taylor expansion in the particle's momentum, and we can an example of this. From something that you also probably know, is when we do the weak interactions, so that's proton, electron, neutron, neutrino, for example, this to first approximation goes like g squared over mw squared times j mu. J mu. So when we do weak interactions, we get that. But if I took this propagator here, I have 1 over mp squared minus mw squared. Now let's be a little bit more consistent. Let's just make that q squared. So I get minus 1 over mw squared to start with, then I get minus q squared over mw to the fourth, next order term, plus dot, dot, dot. So this would also have g squared over mw to the fourth, j, weak box j, as its next order term. We would, in principle, do that. So this this organizing principle of organizing that. We don't have to do that for almost anything in the weak interactions, though you can, in principle, see that in muon decay. There is a q squared over mw squared correction, which, since it's very precise, is at the limits of observability. Okay, that's fine. Third organizing principle is also something we've seen. And that's what we did in the QED case, is what I'll call matching or measuring. Okay, so if we have a known theory, which we do in QED, we can actually write down the effective Lagrangians that are consistent with the gauge invariants, order them in this energy expansion, but then we have to get their coefficients somehow. If it's a known theory, we match it onto the known theory. The beauty of this, it's still a value. You still need it to do something in the original theory, but you only have to do it one time. Every time you want to apply this, you don't have to go off and do it again. You've matched it onto the low energy effect. If you're talking about a theory like general relativity, where we don't know the high energy theory, this would be, you would have to go out and measure these things, just like you do for regular coupling constants. So unknown or difficult. Okay, so the unknown theory would be general relativity. The known theory where it's difficult would be like QCD. When we write these effective Lagrangians for QCD, we applied them decades before there were any calculations on the lattice to predict them. Okay. So any questions on that? This is my initial discussion of the three organizing principles, and we're going to cycle back through various iterations, seeing these work in more detail and more settings. This is sort of the break in the initial presentation. Okay? Anyone want to ask a question at this stage? Yes. I found my questioner. Here's a dollar.
By matching, I understand that you say do a one loop calculation and measure something in the lab, and then you can match your coupling constant.
Right.
But when you're saying when something like QCD or something where it is difficult, like just doing one loop calculation is not enough because our coupling constant is large or something like that. So in that case, what do you mean by measuring?
That's what I mean, exactly. So in a difficult theory like QCD, these coefficients can't be calculated in perturbation theory. So the way that, in principle these days, they can be calculated by doing a lattice simulation and then looking at how the results depend, on the energy scales involved, and you can pick out the higher energy dependence and pull out the coefficients out of correlation functions, and then you take those and you go off and apply them to phenomenology. But in practice, the interesting phenomenology that was done with these effective Lagrangians in QCD was started in the 80s before, so what have we done 40 years ago? That ages me, makes me feel old, but we're done well before the calculations could be done. And so you just did one calculation, you went out and measured it, took it off and applied it this, and this, and this. You just do the one measurement and you've got a lot of physics out of it. And so this is actually something that's really, in a way, surprising, that when you have an unknown or difficult to solve high energy theory that lives at high energies, like quantum gravity or QCD being difficult, it doesn't imply enormous difficulties at low energies. You've taken all that difficulty of trying to solve it, and you put it into a small set of numbers, you know, four numbers, five numbers or something, because those are the only structures that can occur at low energies in such a theory, consistent with the symmetries of the theory. So it's actually amazing that you can do that, the theory is uncalculable, but really it's just a couple numbers that need to be calculated. So that's the power of effective field theory is visible right there. Okay, any questions? More questions?
And what about the fact that the light part, the low energy particles would contribute with these non-local terms?
Yes.
And that's why we know that there are no other such particles or not coupled.
Well, so the theory is defined by the symmetries mm-hmm. and the low energy degrees of freedom. So you have to also go out and measure what are your low energy degrees of freedom. But given that combination, then you're in business. You go off, you write out the effective Lagrangians, but you do the dynamical calculations with your low energy degrees of freedom, and you're golden. Okay, great.
Okay.
Anything else? So there's a question of whether I want to end now or just do a tiny start of my next topic, which is path integrals.
Yeah.
All right. So what I'll do is, again, I'm not completely sure everyone's background, but I definitely want to use path integral language here. And so let me at least tell you what I'm going to use. And I'm going to introduce it, probably not today, actually, looking at the clock. But I'll introduce it in a hand-waving way. But more interestingly for you is maybe use it in a concrete way. I'll do a few calculations along the way where I'll use the path integrals. And I'll always show you how to reproduce it in non-path integral language. But I just want to use that language. I think it's important for understanding it. So here's the things that I will use. So I'm going to use it to define the existence of the theory, the quantization, the idea that we quantize. So with path integrals, we don't do commutators, we don't do operators, everything is a function. The function that we use is a generating functional, which will give me the matrix elements of theory, and I just use this to define my quantum theory. D phi, it's written in this form, e to the I integral d for x. It's the Lagrangian of phi and d phi. And there's a piece, a coupling here, which is called a source, which lets me manipulate the theory. The integral is over all paths, over all field variables at each point in space-time. value of the field at each point. And again, I'm going to come back and motivate this a little bit, but probably not today. But I'm going to use this. Now, this is I can't imagine a scarier mathematical concept, or one that makes a true mathematician vomit more. It's really an ugly beast. Most of those paths are not smooth. They're discontinuous. But it's easy to use. So in fact, the other thing I'm going to use, number two, is the free field form of this. So no interactions. But this is used to generate perturbation theory, so it's lovely to use. And it's also used to generate some effective Lagrangians. If L is just L0, which in this case I would just take to be the a scalar field, then that function, that god-awful function, is just a number times e to the I integral d4x, d4y, j at x, I df, the Feynman propagator at x minus y, j at y. So in fact, taking the free field case and calculating it, you get a definition of the Feynman propagator. And the third thing I'm going to use, though probably a little, well, we'll see. It depends on timing. I'm a little slower on timing here, so I'm going to use the quadratic form, the Gaussian integral, if I have integral d phi e to the minus I integral d4x phi some differential operator phi. So the differential operator is like box plus m squared in the case that we have here. But it can be more complicated. I hope to use this. This is some number times the determinant of the differential operator to the minus a half, which is then using a formula which we can say in more detail some other time, is equals e, some again, some number in front here, e to the I is minus I over 2 integral d4x, x times the logarithm of that differential operator. Okay, now that mathematicians are a little happier with that one, perhaps. That's something that's there. But we can actually, for example, when we're doing background field method, we can pull out physics from using that expression. It's not as terrible as it looks. The log of a differential operator. Okay, so let's actually stop there. If you want a little review of path integrals or want to see something, again, download the dynamics of the standard model. There's an appendix in there, which is supposed to be a presentation of path integral treatments using things that I like to use. And I intend also eventually to do what's in the next appendix that's in the same book, which is the heat kernel methods. How much I get to, we'll see. But anyhow, there is material there for you to use to take a bit of a review. And then we'll come back and do this language more in the context of effective field theories next time. Okay?
Thank you, John.
Sure.